Hi, thank you for joining us for Criminally Listed Presents Into the Killing after our short hiatus. In this week's episode, we'll be discussing a murder that had no shortage of suspects, but it would take decades before a very clever detective ultimately solved the case. The case we're covering today happened in a city with a name that doesn't seem like it would be the site of a horrific murder. That city is Pleasanton, California, which is in the East Bay region. In fact, murders were uncommon there. Between 1945 and 1984, there had only been 5 murders in Pleasanton. It's a wealthy city, and it's home to the headquarters of over a dozen major corporations. This includes Oracle, Safeway, and Gap Incorporated. At the 1980 consensus, the city had a population of about 35,000 people, but the city was growing rapidly. In 1990, its population was over 50,000 people. The case we're talking about happened in the first week of April 1984. The number one song in America was Footloose by Kenny Loggins. The top movie at the box office was the comedy Police Academy. That week, President Ronald Reagan called for an international ban on chemical weapons. In the spring of 1984, Tina Fails was 14 years old, and she lived with her mother, Shirley, and her 8-year-old half-brother, Drew. Shirley worked at a 7-Eleven and cleaned houses on the side. Tina was a quiet teenager and didn't stick out too much at school. But for some reason, she got some unwanted attention from a group of girls who decided to torment her. Often, the girls would bully her on the bus. Tina planned on finishing out the year and then transferring schools. On the morning of April 5th, 1984, Shirley drove Tina to school, and then Tina was planning on walking home at the end of the day. April 5th was an unusual day at Tina's high school. A teacher found a 16-year-old freshman named Steven Carlson locked inside a dumpster. He had been in there for about 15 minutes. When Steven got out, he was covered in food and other garbage. The teacher noticed that Steven smelled like alcohol. The teacher told Steven to go to the principal's office. Instead, Steven walked off the school campus towards his home. It turned out that a sophomore named Rob Tremblay had brought alcohol to school that day, and several students had gone drunk. They said that Steven had started acting obnoxious, so several young men locked him in the dumpster. At lunch, a group of 4 or 5 girls threw rocks at Tina. They told her they were going to beat her up at the end of the day. When classes were over, Tina was supposed to go to detention. Tina got detention because she was frequently late for classes in the morning. She was often late because she was avoiding the girls who were bullying her. That afternoon, Tina didn't end up going to detention. After school, Tina was seen walking towards her home. Several students would take a shortcut near the school that involved walking through a long drainage pipe that led to a gully that went under Interstate 680. Tina was one of those students who often took the shortcut. It was a fast way to get from the school to the neighborhood where Tina lived with her family. Shortly after 3 p.m., a truck driver was driving on Interstate 680, and he happened to look in the gully near the drainage pipe. He saw someone lying motionless. He decided to circle back to get a better look. When he did, he saw the body of a young woman covered in blood. He got back into his truck and then went looking for a payphone. He came across a police officer, and the officer used their radio to report the discovery of the body. Several students also came across the body and they called 911. Officers arrived in the area not long afterward, and it was clear that the young woman was dead. Based on items in the backpack found near the body, they determined it was the dead body of 14-year-old Tina Fales. It was clear she had been stabbed dozens of times. The medical examiner would later determine that she had been stabbed 44 times in the back, neck, and face. She had not been sexually assaulted. She also had not been robbed. In a tree above the body was a purse. An officer retrieved it. Inside the purse were items that indicated it belonged to Tina. The police started looking at people who have wanted to kill Tina. For a 14-year-old girl who wasn't involved in something like gang activity, there was an astonishing number of persons of interest. The first were the girls who bullied her. They admitted that they gave her a hard time, but they swore they didn't kill her. The girls were able to provide alibis like they were in detention, so they were cleared as persons of interest. The police talked to several students at the school. One of them was Stephen Carlson, who had been locked in the dumpster earlier that day. He said that around the time of the murder, he was driving his car in the area. He said he saw Tina head towards the culvert. He also said he saw a fellow student, Jeff Michelson, run towards the drainage pipe. So the police investigated Jeff, and they learned that he was one of the school's more notorious bullies. He was one of the kids who locked Stephen in the dumpster. Also, Jeff apparently inappropriately touched several girls at school. Perhaps most damning was that Jeff was known to carry a hunting knife. When the police talked to Jeff, they noticed he had a cut on one of his index fingers. The police thought that this was interesting because they knew from the marks on Tina's body that the knife used to kill her did not have a guard. So they thought that the killer's hand might have slid down the blade during the attack and he might have cut himself. Jeff had two stories about how he cut his finger. He first told the police that he worked at a pizzeria and he cut his finger on a pan. When he was asked about it later, he said that he cut it replacing a hood vent at work. Because of the two conflicting stories, the police ended up getting a search warrant for Jeff's home. They found two hunting knives. They were tested, and no traces of blood were found. But the police didn't feel like they had enough to arrest Jeff. And the police didn't think that a student was capable of committing such a violent murder. Nevertheless, Jeff Michelson remained a person of interest. The police moved on and investigated other persons of interest. One of them had been dating Tina's mother, Shirley. His name was Keith Fitzwater. They had dated for 2 years, but Fitzwater had recently moved out. He had started to drink a lot, and he had a bad temper. Shirley's friends and family thought he was abusive, but Shirley denied that. A few days before the murder, Tina had yelled at Fitzwater to leave her mother alone. On the day Tina was murdered, Fitzwater was at work. When he found out that Tina had been murdered, his boss drove him over to Shirley's home. Before he got dropped off, he handed his boss a knife and told him to hold on to it for him. When Fitzwater was asked about this, he said it would not have been appropriate for him to bring the knife into her home. But since Fitzwater was at work when the murder was committed, he was cleared as a person of interest. Another person of interest was a friend of Fitzwater named John Anderson. Anderson had served in Vietnam and he was known for his violent outbursts, especially when he drank. One night, he was at Shirley's home and he was very intoxicated. He went into Tina's room several times that night. He did not physically hurt her, but he did scare her. But the police were able to eliminate Anderson as a suspect because he had an airtight alibi. Another suspect emerged 5 days after Tina was murdered. On April 10, 1984, a 23-year-old man named Walter Nyman fondled a 16-year-old girl who was walking home from her bus stop in Felton, California. Felton is about 55 miles from Pleasanton. Nyman grabbed the girl as she was exiting a tunneled bridge. Nyman told her to do what he said, or he would kill her. The girl managed to escape, and she called the police. Nyman was arrested several weeks later. The police thought that there were enough similarities between that attack and Tina's murder, so the police investigated Nyman. It turned out that when Tina was killed, Nyman was living in Pleasanton. The police also found out that on the night of Tina's murder, Nyman unexpectedly showed up at his grandmother's home. He was visibly upset. He said that he was not happy with the way his life was going. The police searched Nyman's home and they found bloody clothes and two bloody knives. The blood was tested and it turned out to be animal blood. The police couldn't find any evidence linking Nyman to Tina's killing, so he wasn't charged with her murder. But he remained a person of interest. It turned out that Tina was not the only teenage girl in the area to be murdered recently. On December 2, 1983, 4 months before Tina was killed, 14-year-old Kelly Jean Poppleton was murdered in a wooded area in an unincorporated area just outside of Pleasanton. She had been beaten, suffocated, and stabbed. Less than 3 weeks after Tina's murder, on April 25, 1984, 18-year-old Julie Connell was found stabbed to death. She was last seen in Hayward, California, which is about 60 miles west of Pleasanton. On November 28, 1984, 7 months after the last murder, 18-year-old Lisa Monzo went missing from Hayward. Her body was found 4 days later. She had been strangled to death. Was it possible that Tina and the other young women were killed by a serial killer? The police thought it was possible. Sadly, no arrests were made in any of the cases in the years after the murders. On January 30, 1989, 13-year-old Eileen Mischoff vanished as she was walking from her middle school in Dublin, California, to her skating coach's home. She was last seen walking along a ditch which kids use as a shortcut. It was about 5 miles from where Tina was killed. Eileen was never seen again. It turned out that Eileen attended the same middle school that two of the murdered girls attended years earlier, Kelly Poppleton and Tina Fales. Like the other cases, Eileen's case went cold. In the mid-1990s, DNA technology started to be used more frequently by police departments in the United States. In 1994, DNA evidence proved that a 35-year-old man named Michael Lyde killed 18-year-old Lisa Monzo. When the connection was made, Lyde was serving a life sentence in Washington for raping and murdering a 66-year-old woman. After he was linked to the murder of Monzo, he became a suspect in the murders of Kelly Poppleton, Julie Connell, and Tina Fales. However, no evidence connected him to those three murders. But one person who was sure that I was the killer was Tina's mother, Shirley. In fact, she was sure she had even met Ide. She thought that they had met at a barbecue a few years earlier. She looked through her photo collection and she found a photograph of a man she was sure was Ide. but it turned out that the man in the photograph was not Ide. In November 1996, Ide was convicted of Lisa Monzo's murder. The following year, he was sentenced to death. As we mentioned before, no evidence linked him to the other murders, so he wasn't charged, but he remained a person of interest. On December 2nd, 1997, there was another murder of a young woman. 22-year-old Vanessa Lee Sampson was kidnapped less than half a mile away from where Tina had been stabbed to death. Sampson's body was found over 200 miles away in Lake Tahoe 2 days later. She had been strangled to death. The people responsible for her murder were James Anthony DeVeggio and Michelle Lynn Machado. The couple was arrested the day after the body was found for a different crime. The couple were on a spree where they would kidnap, torture, and rape women. They had committed 6 rapes before they kidnapped Sampson. Besides the location where Sampson was kidnapped, something else caught the attention of the investigators regarding James DeVeggio. DeVeggio had attended the same high school as Tina, but he went there 7 years before Tina did. Also, DeVeggio's parents live close to the crime scene. In fact, his family's backyard backs onto the creek where Tina was killed. DeVeggio was familiar with the area where Tina was killed. At the time of Tina's murder, DeVeggio was living in Livermore, which is about 6 miles from Pleasanton. His wife said he was drinking heavily and using meth at the time. But no evidence was found that connected him to Tina's murder. So he was added to the list of persons of interest. DeVeggio and Michelle Lynn Machado were convicted of killing Vanessa Sampson, and they were both sentenced to death. In 1996, another murder of a young woman was solved. DNA linked a man named Robert Rhodes to the murder of 18-year-old Julie Connell. Rhodes' DNA was entered into a database after he was arrested in 2016 for kidnapping, torturing, and stabbing to death an 8-year-old boy named Michael Lyons in Yuba City, California. In 1998, Rhodes was convicted of murdering Michael and he was sentenced to death. In the spring of 2007, Rhodes was convicted of killing Julie Connell, and once again, he was sentenced to death. Rhodes was considered a person of interest in Tina's murder, but no physical evidence connected him to the killing, just like every other person of interest. That left 2 unsolved murders and 1 unsolved disappearance, the murders of Kelly Poppleton and Tina Fales, and the disappearance of Eileen Mishloff. In December 2002, the police interviewed James DeVeggio, who killed Vanessa Sampson. They asked him if he murdered the 3 girls. He claimed he didn't, but he did suggest a suspect. He said it was his friend, Walter Nyman. As you may remember, Nyman was arrested after he attempted to rape a 16-year-old girl 5 days after Tina's murder. The police thought that this was very interesting. Nyman had never been ruled out as a person of interest, but no physical evidence connected him to the murder. So, even after interviewing James DeVeggio, the murders and the disappearance remained cold. Tina's murder deeply affected her mother, Shirley, and her half-brother, Drew. Shirley was never the same mentally afterward. Drew became terrified that whoever killed his sister was coming to kill him. He ended up phoning the police several times because he heard strange noises in the backyard. They were both hoping that one day the case would be solved. In the mid-1990s, a woman named Dana Savage joined the Pleasanton Police Department. In 2004, she became a detective. In late 2007, Detective Savage was pregnant, so she couldn't do field work or have contact with suspects. So she started looking through cold cases. One of those cases was the murder of Tina Fales. Detective Savage examined the crime scene photos and something caught her eye. It was Tina's purse in the tree. She wondered, how did the purse get up there? She thought that when Tina was being attacked, she wouldn't have thrown it there. She thought, instead, Tina probably would have used it to fend off her attacker. So she thought that the killer threw it into the tree. That meant he was probably the last one to touch it. The purse had been examined for fingerprints, but had never been examined for blood. The police always thought that the killer probably cut himself during the frenzied attack on Tina. Her body didn't show any signs that the knife used in the murder had a guard on it. So the police always thought that the killer's hand might have slid down and he cut himself. They had examined other evidence, like Tina's clothes and her backpack, for the killer's blood and found nothing. So Detective Savage wondered, could there be any traces of the killer's blood on the purse? In August 2008, Detective Savage had the purse submitted for examination. The crime lab didn't have the equipment to look for such small traces of blood, so they sent it to the FBI. It took 2 years before the purse was examined. When it was examined, 4 tiny bloodstains were found on it. In March 2011, Detective Savage received a phone call from the FBI. They had found a match to the DNA on the purse. So, whose blood was it? To review, there were several persons of interest. The first was Jeff Michelson, who was considered a bully and carried a knife. He also had a cut on his index finger and didn't have a clear story as to how he cut his finger. Another person of interest was Walter Nyman, who was arrested for attempting to rape a 16-year-old girl 5 days after Tina's murder. There was also Michael Ide, who murdered 18-year-old Lisa Monzo in November 1984, about 7 months after Tina was killed. Another suspect was James DeVeggio, who kidnapped 22-year-old Vanessa Sampson about half a mile away from where Tina was stabbed to death. Finally, there was Robert Rhodes, who murdered 18-year-old Julie Connell nearly 3 weeks after Tina was killed. From her investigation, Detective Dana Savage thought it was going to be one of 2 men. She thought it was either going to be Walter Nyman or James DeVeggio. She was surprised to hear that the DNA had been linked to a man named Stephen Carlson. She remembered the name, but who exactly was Stephen Carlson? We mentioned Stephen Carlson at the beginning of the podcast. Do you remember who he was? He was the 16-year-old boy who got locked in the dumpster on the day Tina was murdered. He was also the person who said he saw Jeff Michelson in the area where the murder was committed. The investigators then took a closer look at Stephen Carlson. Stephen was born in December 1967. He was the second of 4 children. Like Tina, Stephen was bullied by kids at school. Many people thought he was weird and creepy. In middle school, he was given the nickname Creepy Carlson. Although he was never diagnosed, many people said, in hindsight, he probably had ADHD. He was known to act inappropriately around girls. For example, he chased one of his sister's friends around the pool while he was naked. Another time, he entered a neighbor's home while a teenage girl was showering. He went into the bathroom and flung open the shower curtain. One of Tina's friends accused Stephen of raping her multiple times. She said that one time he brought a group of boys to rape her. In 1983, when Stephen was 15, he started using marijuana and methamphetamine. Once he started using meth, he became more aggressive. One day, he got in a fight with another boy at school, and the teacher who broke it up thought that Stephen would have killed the boy had he not intervened. After Tina's murder, Stephen used meth more frequently, and his behavior became worse. He ended up serving time in a juvenile detention center. Stephen had confessed to killing Tina to several people. Usually, he was intoxicated when he did it. In 1986, while Stephen was in juvenile detention, he was questioned about Tina's murder by detectives. He denied committing the murder. In the summer of 1989, 22-year-old Stephen attempted to rape a 13-year-old girl. He was convicted of lewd and lascivious acts on a child, and he was sentenced to 3 years of prison. He served a little less than 2 years. When he was released, he had to register as a sex offender. Stephen continued to do drugs and drink heavily. He was in and out of jail, usually for not registering as a sex offender. In December 2010, Stephen was homeless in Santa Cruz, California, and he was arrested for possession of meth. He was forced to give a sample of his DNA, and it was submitted to CODIS. In July 2011, after his DNA was linked to Tina's murder, Stephen was interviewed by detectives. They told him they were there to question him about Tina's murder, and he started dry heaving. But he denied committing the murder. Nevertheless, he was arrested for Tina's murder in August 2011. Since Stephen was 16 when the murder was committed, his lawyer argued that he should be tried in juvenile court. Stephen Carlson's trial was supposed to start on February 13, 2014. But it got pushed back to October 2014. Tragically, Tina's mother, Shirley, died on the day the trial should have started at the age of 66 from a heart attack. Stephen Carlson's trial started 3 years after he was arrested on October 14, 2014. The trial lasted 2 weeks. The jury deliberated for about a day. 30.5 years after Tina Fail's murder, Stephen Carlson was found guilty of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to 26 years to life. In January 2017, his conviction was reduced to second-degree murder. It was determined that the prosecution had not proved premeditation. With the reduced conviction came a new sentence. He was sentenced to 16 years to life in prison. Even after Stephen Carlson was convicted, he maintained he was innocent. Then in 2020, he sent several letters to Tina's family and one to Tina herself, where he takes responsibility for the murder and he apologizes. He wrote, "This letter of my deepest apologies is way overdue. I was living in denial for many years, not being able to believe or take responsibility for brutally murdering you on that day of April 5th, 1984. I want you and your family to know you did absolutely nothing to deserve what I did to you. That's what makes this murder so callous and horrific." He also wrote about what he was feeling on the day of the murder. He wrote, "I remember being full of rage at the way all my classmates were laughing at me and the damage my parents' room was in and how my dad was going to whip up on me after they found out about the party I threw. Everything happened so fast. I remember going to the kitchen and grabbed a butcher knife. I walked across the street into the field at the gully. That's where, at the time, was Tina Fail's. I don't remember the stabbing motions. I just remember standing over her bloody body holding a bloody knife." Stephen Carlson is currently serving a sentence at the California Correctional Institution in Tehachapi, California. He'll be able to apply for parole in 2023. In this episode, we talked about the murders and disappearances of several young women. Two of the cases we mentioned remain unsolved. The first one is the murder of 14-year-old Kelly Poppleton. She was strangled, beaten, and stabbed to death in December 1984, just outside of Pleasanton. We also talked about the disappearance of 13-year-old Eileen Mishloff. She disappeared from Dublin, California in January 1989 and has never been seen again. One question you may have, is Stephen Carlson responsible for either one of those crimes? What is known is that Stephen was not responsible for the disappearance of Eileen. That's because he was in prison at the time she disappeared. No evidence connects him to Kelly Poppleton's murder, and he's never been publicly identified as a person of interest. Both Kelly and Eileen's cases are considered cold. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. As always, our fact checker, producer, and sound designer was Adele Coutier. We had two major sources when it came to writing this episode. The first is the excellent book, Murder in Pleasanton, Tina Fails and the Search for Justice by Josh Shushan. It's a fantastic book and I cannot recommend it enough. Another major source was the show Cold Case Files. They profiled Tina's murder in the episode She Never Came Home. If you like this podcast, please subscribe or follow so you don't miss any future episodes. If you just discovered this podcast, please check out Criminally Listed on YouTube. We have nearly 300 videos featuring some unsettling and bizarre true crime stories. You can find it at youtube.com/criminallylisted. Well, that's all for this week. Thank you again for listening.